You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
And that was Life's What You Make It by Talk Talk. And here in the studio today, welcome to the Stone Tapes, we have with us David J. Howe.
Hello, hello, hello.
We have Patricia H. Ash.
Hi.
And our special new recruit, George Mann.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, George Mann, everybody.
Hi, welcome, George.
Thank you very much.
And of course, with us, I'm controlling all the buttons, I mean, who we couldn't manage without, Alex Levchuk. I know you can't speak, Alex, because we took the mic away from you, but I'll tell them all you're waving.
He's waving. Alex is waving.
We're going to have a little change of routine today, because normally at this point we go straight to Patricia's Corner, but today we're going to introduce you to the Man Factor and talk to George a little bit and hear about what he's been researching as particularly the DC Comics.
Yeah, so thanks, Sam. The man factor, I'm hoping it's a bit easier than the Krypton factor for people. Yeah, I wanted to talk about a subject that's very close to my heart, which is comics. I've been a comics reader for a long time. I obviously write comics professionally, and one of the things I've been following very closely recently is the new relaunch of DC Comics, which they've called Rebirth. And I don't know how much you guys follow comics, but I think the reason that you're seeing this happen a lot more in comics recently is that you get a new number one. Instead of
a new issue
number one for starting, so you'll have an ongoing series, say Superman, which might have in the past run for hundreds and hundreds of issues, and it's all numbered sequentially. Now you tend to get story arcs of perhaps 12 issues, 30 issues, 50 issues, and then they start again with a new number one. And I've been kind of poking at that and looking at that, and I think there's a number of reasons why they do it. It's just largely to entice new readers. Here's a jumping on point for people. If you've never been interested in Superman before, it might look a bit impenetrable to come up to it and go, that's 600 issues. But to start with a new number one is a launching point. And I think what we're seeing with DC Rebirth as well is they're cleaning out the house a little bit as well. They're tidying up all the storylines because it's all one big universe and all the comics are linked. And they're trying to kind of move things in a new direction, so they have to tie things up and start them again. But it's been a fascinating thing to jump on board, because what's worked for me is those new number ones have actually made me interested in the characters. Some DC comics that I've read for a long time, the Batman comics particularly, but others that I've never really kind of engaged with. Like Superman's a great example. Wonder Woman is another example of characters I'm aware of, but I've never really kind of followed closely other than TV and film.
Do you think this is why they've suddenly become so much bigger? I mean, obviously, we've had the DC superhero movies in recent years. Do you think this has made it a lot more popular in terms of comic strips as well?
I think that's another reason for the timing of it, actually. When you look at it, you see that we've just had Batman vs. Superman, which, obviously, there's been mixed reviews for that film for a whole number of reasons. But, actually, what that's done is it's put tension on those characters.
Interesting.
That had Wonder Woman, Batman, Superman in it. And again, you're going to see people who haven't engaged with comics watching the film and going, oh, actually, I'm interested in finding out a bit more about these. Oh, look, there's 600 issues to catch up on.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it helps. You go issue one, or even five or six issues, you can go, well, that's easy enough to catch up. I can jump in.
That's really interesting
this.
Because I think you have the same problem when you're watching a series, a new series on, and you're always, Battlestar Galactica being one of those, because the new series was so many episodes. If you didn't start at the beginning of that, I think you would have a real big problem getting into it and being on it. And now that seems to be becoming a theme in comic strips, which I think it makes sense to me, because I'm now actually more interested in going and having a look at those because you've said that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, I'm actually the completely the opposite base, though. I just think it confuses people. I tend to take the view that if you are involved in creating anything that's ongoing, whether that be a TV series or a series of films or comics or books even, the thing that you have just created, whether it's the first, the 20th, the 300th edition, is going to be somebody's first edition. And you ought to be aware of that and ought to be able to make that accessible to that person stepping into that as the first thing that they see. I think readers, viewers are not stupid, and they will understand that there is a plot that's ongoing here, yeah, and that they can understand that is happening, that they've missed some of it. You kind of get that. But equally, you don't want it to be so unaccessible that you have no way of stepping onto that issue and understanding what happens. And I think by taking it and saying, well, we're going to do a new number one, I mean, first of all, with my collector hat on, it's like, well, which number one is this? Is this the first 20th, 37th? You know, where am I with this? I mean, I'm even finding this with the Doctor Who comics, as we're trying to understand and catalogue them to some extent. And you see a cover, and it's got number five. Well, is that number five volume one, or number five year two, or what is it? And you just don't know where you are with it anymore. So I'm the opposite camp. I'm more of the... It's something I think the creators should be thinking about all the time anyway. And if your product is so inaccessible that you have to start again, to allow people to access it, then maybe you're not doing it right in the first place.
Well, I think they probably were doing it right.
I
think they probably were doing it right. What I see with this is, though, that it's kind of like it's the readership mentality that they're actually addressing here, isn't it? To say that 600 ahead of you is absolutely terrifying.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you're a collector, no way you're going to be able to find all those anyway, because there'll be some of them that are very rare.
That's the challenge for the collector.
Oh, well, if you're really that kind of collector,
you see,
David,
yeah,
like
yeah,
you are.
Absolutely. You see, with a collector brain on, it's like, well, I'm just going to collect this year's issues then. I won't worry about the other ones because I've got my set of 12.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in any of the other
but
ones.
Maybe that's the point.
Well, I suppose, yeah. You see, because they're always looking forward. I mean, obviously, they've got this wealth of back catalogue, but they go wide as well as you know, so that you've got Justice League, Trinity, Wonder Woman, Superman, Batman, Detective Comics, Action Comics, yada, yada, mm-hmm. yada. And all, that's one story moving forward. And again, that's one of the problems, I think, actually, what you were talking about things getting too convoluted, is... It's kind of okay if you're just a Superman fan and you're just following the Superman stories, but if you're interested in the DC universe,
right.
then actually what happens is it just gets more and more entangled as time goes on.
Overlaps.
So give it 5 years' time, and they'll be looking to reboot again because everything will have become kind of.
Is Marvel doing this with the comics as well?
Yeah, absolutely. They've just had kind of whole battle world scenario where they collapsed all of their alternate universes into one, and basically consolidated everything. Because they used to have kind of this version of Earth and that version of Earth and that version of Earth, where you might have the same characters, but they've got different histories.
Oh, that's too hard work.
Really confusing.
Too hard.
Their own back, really, don't they? They kind of sounds like they've kind of overcomplicated it to the extent that it's almost this universe just needs to explode. start with a new universe.
And that
now.
Is pretty much what happens. But at the same time, as a reader,
it's
I've kind of gone. What DC have done is really refreshing,
mm.
actually, because they've kind of responded to that. Some of the criticism they were having of the Batman Superman film and the fact that it was going a bit dark and a bit grim and a bit adult, and they've gone, actually, where's the fun? We want to put the fun and the joy back into it. So there's a real kind of statement behind Rebirth where they've gone, no, the pages are colourful again. They're not all shadowy and, you know, sepia washed.
Right.
It jumps off the page. They're wearing colourful costumes.
That's very different.
And there's a real emotional tone to it as well, you know, an undercurrent.
Well, I'm sure they've got writers like you, George, in there. There will be well-written stories as well,
There's some brilliant writers working on these. I would love to write for DC. One day, hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. And I must admit, I haven't looked at any sort of Superman comics since I was a child, I have to be honest.
Right.
But I'm actually really interested in checking these out now and seeing what's going on with them.
There's some great stuff in there. But I think, it's also indicative of the fact we're kind of living in reboot culture these days, aren't we, as well? And that's the thing that we tend to see happening in all media. You touched on TV as well.
Absolutely.
But everything
we're
tends
talking
to get...
of which, they're rebooting Star Trek, the series as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
A sky of stars in poise, perpetual turquoise. We grew. Do you love it too? I dream I'm made of gold, striking to behold. I spin under the moon, dance to nature's tune. Crystal rain, blooming flowers stay. through June. And that was Lindsay Gold with Through June, and I'm hoping that's going to bring some sunshine to very rainy Lincolnshire at the moment. Patricia, you just mentioned to me a series that you said has just been rebooted.
Yes, Netflix has just done a reboot of Voltron.
What is Voltron?
It was a cartoon from the 80s. There's these robots that combine to form a larger robot, and there's people
like
driving the robots. Kind of, but it started as Japanese anime, and then was one of the first anime shows that made the jump to American
Voltron.
Television.
I've never heard of
You've
one.
Never
no.
heard of Voltron?
No.
Oh, well, I guess it was an American thing
wow.
then. My husband was a huge fan of the original show, of which he has several seasons. And when he saw this thing on Netflix, he was like, honey, you have to watch this with me. And I did. And I watched some of the old show and some of the new show, and it looks really cool. They've taken a lot of the things that people really liked about the old show and put them in the new show.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Just being shown some pictures.
We're just having a look at some of this online by Alex. Yes, I do recognise it now.
This is, again, picking up, obviously, what you were saying there, George. I mean, on television, we've had things like Captain Scarlet.
Thunderbirds.
Thunderbirds, of course.
CGI.
Danger Mouse recently.
Danger Mouse has been on. I've not seen the new one.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Danger Mouse. Is there any others that...
Well, Sam had mentioned Star Trek just before the song.
Yeah, and they're doing a new series of this now. But, of course, Star Trek continues. And although not official, was already doing a little bit of a reboot. And
Star Trek's interesting, isn't it? Because they've got the film reboots.
Yes.
And then they've got this TV reboot. And we're not even sure that yet whether they're going to be the same universe or...
Absolutely.
Because I think a lot of people come up and say, oh, it's a reboot. And it's... Well, is it?
Is it a reboot or a new series?
Is it just they made a film with a new cast? Does that just make it a reboot? I mean, what's interesting about the Star Trek, the new films, the Abrahams films, is that, yes, it's a new cast. Yes, they're playing the characters of the same names. But I think there are several key differences with what was established in the original series with those characters and their backstories and who they were and how they kind of interrelate. And you can say, well, actually, then this is a different universe. This isn't quite the same as we had
before. It's meant to be an alternative timeline, isn't it?
It's meant to be some sort of alternative version of it. But people should jump on this. I mean, Doctor Who, of course, when it came back in 2005, everyone goes, oh, it's a reboot. Was it really?
No,
I mean,
it
was still a Doctor and a TARDIS with a companion.
It was a continuation.
It was a continuation.
But it is one of those things, isn't it? It's an interesting, because it is about where you draw the line and how you present it to people. Because actually, that's essentially what DC are doing. They're not throwing out all the old continuity. They're just going, here's a new... We're going to restate everything. We're going to restate what's important to our stories, and this is a jumping-on point for you. And they kind of look at that and go, well, that's what Doctor Who does every time they get a new production team
in, absolutely.
And they regenerate the Doctor.
Yes. Yeah.
You go, that's what we did with... What Moffat did with Matt Smith. He took over. There was a whole new...
A stepping-on point.
Whole new behind-the-scenes team and a whole new in-front-of-camera team, and...
And what's interesting is that Doctor Who has actually always done this. I mean, I always smile when I watch Tomb of the Cybermen. I mean, it's not Pat Troughton's first story. It's bang slap in the middle of Troughton's era. But you watch that story from the beginning, and it actually opens with a scene where the Doctor brings Victoria into the TARDIS and says, hello, this is me, I'm the Doctor, this is Jamie, this is the TARDIS. Yes, it's bigger on the inside than there, and we travel in time and we have adventures. Right, okay, off we go. You know, and it's like, it's a summary of this is what it's all about.
Yeah.
So Doctor Who has kind of done that from time to time, provided a sort of stepping on point, which is interesting. So, I mean, how important do you think stepping on points are?
Well, I don't know. I think it's really interesting, and it's a thing. As a writer, it's a thing that I've been thinking a lot about, especially, you know, pondering on this kind of DC thing. Is I've got an ongoing series of novels. Book 5 is done and is coming out. And there's a book 6 in the works. And I'm looking at books 7, 8, and 9.
Wow.
I'm jumping one.
You're not
going
to write that one.
No, not yet.
7 doesn't count.
But then I kind of go, well, is there a point when people are going to look at those books and go, I don't know where to start? And is there a way to present them to go, start here?
That's a very interesting point, actually,
because
I have the same issue, George, and I understand exactly what you are, and each time you write a new book in a series, you almost have to do a little bit of establishing the universe again, and a little bit of referencing, a little bit of continuity referencing, if it's important, and more often than not in a series it is, unless you're literally setting out to do an adventure in each story, and there's no real link. But I think it's very hard to do when you've got the same cast of characters that you have no continuity.
Yeah,
so I always say to people when they want to do, you know, start with the beginning. But, you know, really, we should be writing stuff that is standalone as much as we can anyway. And I'm sure you try and do that.
I 100% agree with that. And I think what David said earlier about every book is someone's first book.
Yeah.
They're going to pick it up and they need to be able to understand where they are within a few pages, just like the Tomb of Cybermen.
That's it.
And,
yeah.
and start reading and enjoy it. But at the same time, from a sales and marketing point of view, is this sort of thing a tool for helping tell people where, you know, you can start here. Mm. You can start with this new book.
I mean, authors have done various things over the years. I mean, I'm reminded of Brian Lumley's vampire series, the Necroscope series, which I think, I can't remember now, it ran to something like 6 or 7 volumes, and then he did a prelude series and a post series. And I remember each book started, but I know it was a long kind of a story so far, where he would summarise where we got to with all the characters. So that has been done, a kind of like a little story so far. This is where we are with it all, which is a way of doing it.
I've considered that as well, and I have seen that sort of thing in other books, historical series, for example, because they're so complex. I'm sure that... George Mann, anybody here read Game of Thrones? I'm not a Game of Thrones reader.
I've read a couple of them.
Do they do anything like that to establish it?
They
wow.
Just, not that I've seen.
It. So complex.
Just straight into it because I guess they assume you've read or seen the previous ones.
But do books do reboots? Has there ever been a book series that...
Well, James Bond, I know obviously we've seen reboots and recastings of James Bond, but actually if you read the John Gardner books from the 80s, they're not... The continuity isn't there with the earlier books. It's the same James Bond, it's as if he's living in the 80s and he drives a Saab and you know, he wears a Casio watch.
Whereas presumably the Flemings are all set in the...
In the 60s, 50s and 60s, so they kind of shift him in time. And it's really interesting because it is effectively a reboot.
Interesting. Are there any others?
I'm trying to think of some, but mostly it's series.
It?
I mean, some authors do like a trilogy in this chunk of their universe, and then a trilogy in another chunk of their universe, and then a trilogy in another chunk of their universe.
Because David Eddings wrote all of his series, but each one was kind of like a trilogy, the Belgariad, and then the... I can't remember the names of them now.
The other one.
I think he did 3 or 4, but they were 3-book series that kind of fitted together to create an overall thing.
So each one of those chunks has a number one, a number two, a number three, and whatever.
And then you get, as you say, like George R. R. Martin doing his Game of Thrones and Robert Jordan doing his Wheel of Time.
It's just assumed that you've read the other ones.
Which just go on and on and on.
I mean, if it wouldn't be too large to lift and carry, you could put them all in one book.
But called a Kindle. or something
Another e-book reader. Other e-book readers other than Kindle out there.
This is absolutely fascinating.
I mean, you know, talking about reboots in general does make me think very much about some amazing classics we've got out there, like Fright Night, and then they think it's a really good idea to reboot that.
No, I think a lot of the time when you look at Hollywood, get it wrong, because they're looking for what they think is a surefire win, and actually...
And it's not.
The piece works because it's of its time.
Exactly.
And it falls over.
Everything about it was so perfect. How could you possibly recreate it?
And they remade Halloween, which was just dreadful, the remake of
that.
Absolutely. Why? I hear they're remaking Suspiria, and I am dreading seeing a remake of Suspiria. It's one of my favourite films. I go, why would you remake these films? They're just brilliant.
I don't know how anyone could even think they could remake Suspiria. I don't know how they think they could.
It's mental, isn't it? I don't get it. Do people come up and say, I'm going to remake The Third Man? I think that film needs a remake.
Have they not done Citizen Kane, have they?
Have they remade Citizen Kane?
Only a matter of time, I'm sure.
I might have just put that in somebody's head now.
Yeah, I could do that. And then it would be, no, please don't.
Beneath the old iron bridges, across the Victorian parks, and all the frightened people running home before dark, past the Saturday morning cinema, glass crumbling to the ground, and a piss-stinking shopping centre in a new side of town, I've come to smell the seasons change and watch the city as the sun goes down again. Here comes another winter of long shadows and hours. Here comes another winter waiting for utopia, waiting for hell to freeze over. This is the land where nothing changes, a land of red buses and blue bloody babies. This is the place where pensioners are raped and their hearts are being cut from the welfare state. Let the poor drink the milk while the rich eat the honey. Let the bums count their blessings while they count their money.
The Heartland. And now we're going rapidly over to Patricia's Corner. Hey, Patricia.
Hi there.
What have you been reading?
Oh, now I've got a theme song. That's cool. Anyway.
And she actually has a corner as well.
She's got her own
corner.
Yeah,
I do sit in a little corner in the studio with me and my little books. Anyway, what I've been reading this time is The Glass Books of the Dream Eaters, which is kind of awesome. It's by a man called Gordon Dahlquist, who's normally a playwright, but has done this novel and several more, actually, that come after it. He's a very long sort of writer. Each one of these chapters is about 100 pages long. So this is not a book to read if you have anywhere to go in the next 2 days. But if you haven't got anything to do in the next, 2 days, this is the perfect book because it is so exciting. Gordon Dahlquist is a genius for intrigue, and each time the protagonists find something that answers one of their questions, it brings up 60 more, and then there's more peril, and then there's people betraying other people, and you don't know who's on whose side, and it's really, really cool. I should probably tell you kind of what it's about. It's hard to do that without ruining it. So there are three major people that this book follows. One of them is a lady called Miss Temple, and she's in the first chapter. She kicks everything off. She receives this letter from her fiancé, breaking it off with her, which is, I guess, what we would do in Victorian times, like a text message breakup. The Victorian text message. Right, so she wants to know what's up with that, and naturally follows him to a...
Stalks him, as you would.
Yeah.
As you would, yeah.
Well, yes, you want answers from your ex-fiancé here. So she follows him, and then he goes to this party at this creepy mansion in the middle of nowhere. So she naturally follows him, gets into the party, discovers that she's gotten in a bit over her head, like massively over her head, like she's in the Marianas Trench over her head. So there's some murder, and stuff happens, which I won't tell you. I will tell you instead about the other two protagonists. One of them is Cardinal Chang, who is neither Chinese nor... No, he's not a cardinal at all. But this is just the name that... He's a hired killer, actually.
Okay. Oh, he's definitely not a cardinal then.
Nope. Cardinals hire killer. No. No, they don't. Not anymore. Anyway, he gets into this. He was supposed to kill somebody at the party, but that guy was already dead when he got there. So obviously something's up. And then he's, after the party thing, he is engaged by a mysterious lady in red to look for someone who actually turns out to be Miss Temple. And then there's also Dr. Svensson, who is essentially a nursemaid for a boozy German prince whose tiny country is super important somehow, and we're not really sure how.
It's quite a complicated...
Oh, gosh, it is so complicated, which is why you want to set aside a weekend to spend with this book, and it is very much worth it.
Wow.
I would say 8 out of 10, at least.
So now, George, you said just as we were on the song there.
Yeah,
this.
I mean, I've got a copy of this book, and I've not read it, but when it was first published, it was serialized like a Victorian Dickens novel. So I subscribed to it through Penguin, and... I think for 8 weeks we got pamphlets, trade paperback size, and it had like fake Victorian adverts and things in it. And it's a lovely artifact to have.
Wow.
How fascinating.
So would that be like each chapter? So like
I guess that's it, about 100 pages each.
Yeah.
So do you suspect then that he wrote this book in that way, that it was basically serialised?
I don't know, I think it was more,
it's
Patricia
so complex.
Know better than reading it,
my guess would be that he outlined it all first.
Yeah.
Mm. Unless he's just the best seat of the pants writer I've ever seen.
Wow.
Yeah. I think the way they turned up on time every week made me think this isn't someone who's serialized. He's written it in a serialized way, but they were marketing it that way, and
it's fascinating.
So what's it called again, Patricia?
It is called The Glass Books of the Dream Eaters,
and you would. Giving that 8 out of 10.
8 out of 10, at least.
And now we're going to do a bit of Dove's Cry. Gotta love Prince.
The Midweek Drive on Siren FM 107.3.
Are you there?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
This is who we are.
Coffee House Hermits from Lincoln, England. We're all travellers in space and time.
With strange characters.
And it's the one with the nose.
I absolutely love her.
And surprises galore.
A free concert. Think of it as being sung to by Elvis Presley.
Unusual discussion topics.
Why would you want to give every child a water pistol? It was a bit like choosing between kittens and babies.
That will make your ribs soul.
You have really done your homework.
That's what we call show business.
Join the Midweek Drive team every Wednesday from 5 till 7 on Siren FM 107.3.
And you're listening to the Stone Tapes, and joining us now is the wonderful and one of my Bessie friends, Fraser Hines. Hi there.
Hi, Sam. How are you doing?
I'm good.
How's the show going? How's it going?
It's going very, very well, Fraser. We miss you. Wish you were here too.
Well, it's all downhill now that I'm on.
No, I don't think so. I'm sure it's going to get even more upbeat now you're online.
All right.
I wanted to just talk to you because I know you're having a really, really busy year, and I thought that some of our listeners might want to hear about what you're up to.
Well, yes. A show I did 40-odd years ago, Doctor Who, has taken me all around the world. This year I've been to America about five times. I'm off to Alabama soon, and then Long Island. I call it the Long Island Iced Tea Convention, which is rather nice. You've been there many a time as well.
Yes, yes. Hoping to be there again as well myself this year.
And then Chicago. So, you know, I'll have about 8 visits to the United States this year, which is marvellous. You're going for a nice long weekend. I was in Dallas, and I wanted to go and see the grassy knoll where Kennedy was assassinated, and we saw that. And then they said, do you fancy going to Old Cowtown? I said, no, thanks. I might see my ex-wife. And so they said, which one? I went, oh, never, don't start that. But there we saw the Longhorns, and no jokes there either. So it was great. I had a lovely time. You know, always wanted to go to Dallas. And it was really great, great fun.
Well, what's the future holding for you for the rest of the year?
Well, later on in the year, I'm doing a brand new play. Is it called A Play with Music? Written by Leah Bell and Chrissy Rock, the comedian. It's called Seriously Dead, and we're coming all around the country, so we're going as far north as Arbroath and in Scotland and Livingstone and Newcastle, and we're coming to Stamford, which is only about half an hour down the road from where I live. Mansfield we're coming to, and Chesterfield, so I'm sure that's in your catchment area as well. And it's called Seriously Dead with Billy Pearce as well, an old mate of mine, Billy Pearce, and it's a sort of a comedy with music, and I've read the script. It's going to be very, very funny. And then, all going well, we'll do another about 20 dates next year. We're doing 2 nights here, 2 nights there as a test out. And then pantomime. I haven't done pantomime for a few years, and my old mate Chris Marino, who's still in the Theatre Royal Lincoln, he's asked me to do panto with Stuart Wade, funny enough, who used to be Biff in Emmerdale, the old chum I haven't seen for years and years. Debbie McGee's in it. One of the guys from The Chase, the big villain with the black hair, always wears a white suit. I can't remember his name at the moment. So that's going to be fun as well.
Well, Fraser, it sounds like you've really got a full-on time. All of these trips to America must be leaving you a little bit exhausted.
Yeah, I always get jet lagged going over there. But funny, when I get back, it's not too bad when I get back home. But when I get over there, you know, the first night or first 2 nights, I'm up every 2 hours, Sam. You know, 2:15, you look at the clock, 3:18, 5:15, 7:18. Oh, no, you're up and down the whole time. That's not the fun. That's not fun at all.
No, that's not fun. But we will certainly be looking forward to seeing your pantomime, and I'm definitely coming to see Seriously Dead, because with a title like that, I've got a feeling there's something gothic going on in there as well as humour.
I think it sounds like one of the Sam Stone books, don't you? You know, Seriously Dead.
Doesn't it? It sounds like something I could write. Definitely.
Well, Seriously Cat. It'll have to be the next book, Seriously Cat.
Oh, there's a point.
With your cat theme. Mm. Yeah.
There's a point. Fraser, thank you so much. You're an absolute delight.
Not at all. Oh, was that it?
That's it. That was a quickie.
I've waited up, you know, all this time.
Now I'm kicking you off straight away. It's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah. Give my love to your old man as well, and see you soon.
Bless you. See you again.
Bye.
And we're going to shout now. Tears for Fears. Thought we'd do it quickie because we...
Shout, shout,
David, tell us all about your film of the month.
Well, we've got a fantastic film of the month for us this month. It's a little film, which you may have heard of, called The Fifth Element. What always amuses me about this film is that when I first went to see it at the cinema, and the friends I went with kind of gabbled the title at me, and I thought it was called The Fifth Elephant. And I wasn't quite sure exactly what it was we were going to see. Needless to say, it is not about elephants. There are no elephants in it, at least none that I think they'll admit to. Fifth Element, it's a science fiction film. It was made in 1997. And it was directed by Luc Besson, who is we've spoken before on the Stone Tapes, is one of our favourite directors. It stars Bruce Willis, Gary Oldman and Mila Jovovich as the primary cast. It's a really interesting film. It's got such an amazing backstory to it, in that it's all about aliens who kind of secrete on Earth these mystic stones that are somehow going to protect the Earth from the Big Bad when it eventually comes. And then we kind of flash forward to the 23rd century, where Bruce Willis is a taxi driver who drives a flying cab, and some of the visuals are brilliant. Gary Oldman is plays Zorg, who's the head of some multinational corporation.
Probably has something to do with weapons.
Probably has something to do with weapons, yes, and he's a weapons runner as well. And basically, Mila Jovovich comes into it in that she is reconstructed from the organic remains from a spacecraft that crashes after a battle with some other aliens outside the Earth. And she ends up falling into Bruce Willis's cab as it's flying through futuristic New York. And she can't speak any English. And so the film kind of progresses, really. And it goes from one amazing scenario to another. They meet a priest who is the long descendant of the person that was looking after these stones, who knows what's going on here. They end up taking a futuristic liner to a place called Floxton Paradise, which is the most amazing holiday planet, which is where the stones are going to be passed over to Bruce Willis. And there's lots and lots of intrigue going on. Gary Oldman is in there as well, killing everything in sight and behaving very, very evilly and maniacally. And then on Floxton Paradise, we are introduced to probably the Marmite element of the film, which is a rather understated character called Ruby Rod, played by...
He's so subtle.
He's so subtle. Played by Chris Tucker. And now, if you've never seen the film... it is a sight to behold. Is Chris Tucker as Ruby Rod, dressed in a skin tight animal skin cat suit, prancing down the halls of the spaceship whilst narrating a radio show and painting fans' autographs with a great big brush across page. He is absolutely brilliant. It's such a performance. So that's The Fifth Element, really. The film kind of progresses. The big bad comes, he tries to attack, and we won't tell you what happens, but it's incredible. It's got Lee Evans is in it as kind of a captain-type character on the spaceship on Floxton Paradise. It's got people you can spot all the way through. I'm looking at the cast list. I can see John Bluthal. Luke Perry is in it. It's got someone called Tricky, who I think is a rapper, I think.
Oh, okay.
Bristol kind of trip-hop.
Is he a trip-hop?
Trip-hop, like Portishead.
Right. Ian Holm is in it. It's an incredible cast. It's an incredible spectacle. And I think we've all seen it. So what's your thoughts, Patricia?
I love it. And the reason it's a sight to behold is that Jean-Paul Gaultier did the costumes.
Yes.
He did.
That would be why. And everything just looks fantastic. I mean... I love every aspect of this movie.
Just to give you some scale, according to Wikipedia, I think it's 800 costumes Jean-Paul Gaultier designed and created
Holy
for the film.
Cow.
800. And every single day on set, he would go around and check every one of them to make sure it was the way he wanted it.
Well, it was worth it.
Yeah, even down to redesigning the whole McDonald's costumes for the girls.
Yes. That's right, McDonald's still exists.
It still exists in the 23rd century.
It's awesome.
That's amazing. Sam, what do you think?
Well, this is one of my absolute all-time favourite films ever. And it's one of those that I think is ultimately incredibly rewatchable. And every time I'm feeling a little bit like I need cheering up, this film goes on. And I've even got catchphrases now because, you know, you get a little bit of a downpour like we've got at the moment in Lincolnshire, and we definitely are in the outdoor wash. And every time I eat chicken, I have to say chicken good.
Multipass. Yeah. Yes, that one.
And my all-time favourite, when Chris Rock is at the end, Ruby Rod, he's trying to create something, make something happen.
Get the stones to work.
Yeah, get the stones to work. And he actually says, his is broken. Mine, whenever I have an empty wine glass, it's gone, why? Why do I have to get the broken one?
What's your thoughts, George?
I love it. I loved it when it first came out, and I hadn't seen it again since. I think I was saying to you earlier, I had it on VHS. So obviously, you know, long ago, passed all my VHS away. But actually, what struck me about it, there's two things that struck me about watching it again. One is how bright and colourful it is, and watching those scenes where the hover cars are chasing each other, yes, and thinking, comparing it to and contrasting it to something like Blade Runner, which is obviously dystopia. This is, yes, I know it's not a utopia, but it's bright and colourful and fun. Yes. And I think actually that's the other thing that struck me about it, is it times like we're in at the moment with this kind of, with horrible stuff going on in the world, bleak things going on, difficult politics. Actually, something that celebrates fun and camp, yes, and you know, yeah, and it's just, it's brilliant. You know, when, yes, from the moment Bruce Willis walks on with an orange top on and the dyed blonde, yes, hair, and you think, what is this?
This is brilliant.
And you're smiling. You're smiling, yes, all the way through the film.
And I still think it's one of his best performances ever, actually.
I agree.
Yeah. I do.
I think it's tremendous. I mean, I always smile when Ruby Rod comes on.
Absolutely.
For me, the whole film just lifts,
yeah, yes,
when he's on screen, because it is just such an incredible performance. And you mentioned there the word camp, George, and he is very camp, but he's not gay.
Yeah, I nearly said
His character is not gay. It's a different thing entirely. Yeah,
but he is so androgynous in it, and you could half believe that, yeah, he would happily seduce half the guys on the ship as well as half the girls, although it's not stated.
If he had more time on Frost and Paradise, I think it's
not about sexuality. No. It's about campness and actually reveling in that, and yes, the whole film's got that kind of camp undercurrent, and I love it for that.
And we have to, of course, mention Mila Jovovich.
And
she was 18, 19 when she made that film, and the performance is incredible. It's so accomplished and so confident
and emotional.
At times, so emotional. She does such a good job.
She's very much the alien, isn't she? Yes. When you first meet her, she's very kooky and strange and not of this world.
Very alien. No, it's a tremendous film. I mean, I know we'd like to give these things, you know, ratings and stuff, but I mean, it's got to be it's an 11. I think my dog is up to 11 on that one.
11 out of,
yeah. Yeah, I think I'm with you on that.
We're 11 out of 10. So over to you, Sam.
Thank you so much to David J. Howe, Patricia H. Ash, our newbie, George Mann. Thank you so much. Great job done today. And to our producer, Alex Lefchuk, and of course, our telephonic guest, Fraser Hines. Till next time. Dream again, for now.
face.